Trek Profiles Podcast, Episode 16, recorded October 2018. This is the Trek Profiles Podcast, where each episode we sit down with a Star Trek fan. We discover their Trek story, and then we try to understand why Trek matters to them, to you, and to all of us. I'm John, your intrepid host of this whole enterprise, and I welcome you to this, the Trek Profiles Podcast, Episode 16. If you wish to get in touch with us, you can reach us at feedback@trekprofiles.com or on Facebook or Twitter at Trek Profiles. If you wish to leave us a voicemail, you can either send us a voice message using the Tricorder Transmissions website or leave a message at our automated line at 609-512-LLAP. That's 609-512-5527. Warning! As we record this, we are in the middle of the Short Trek series, so all previous Trek content up to and including that point is fair game and may be discussed during this episode. You have been warned, human. With me, as always, is the utterly smashing, simply sensational, sublimely splendorous, but never subversive M5 Multitronic Unit.
M5 reporting at full power.
Let's have the announcements, M5.
Messages displayed.
The Trek Profiles Podcast is a proud member of the Tricorder Transmissions Network. If you haven't checked out our other shows on the network, please visit our website at www.thetricordertransmissions.com and check out the wonderful content posted by my marvelous colleagues on the network. You're going to find something you like, I guarantee it. And if you're enjoying this or any of the shows on the network, please consider supporting the network on Patreon. Support at any level gets you access to extended cuts, early releases, admittance to our Patreon hangouts. Those are always kind of a blast. I'm usually on those hangouts, and I love leading the party games and other zaniness that we do with our Patreon supporters. So I hope to see you there at the next one. If you are listening to us on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or any other platform, we would be very grateful for your likes, your shares, your five-star reviews, or your recommendations. Those things help other Trek fans find us, and we appreciate them so very much. So please take the time, if you haven't, to give us a review. We'd be so grateful. In this episode, we've got some archival material and photos that our guests provided, so if you have an interest in looking at any of that, you will find it all on TrekProfiles.com. If you haven't liked my page on Facebook, feel free to do that. Every now and then I'm doing some Facebook Live events, and so if you want to learn about those, that's probably the best place. So check out what I'm doing there, and maybe we can talk some Trek and hang out. All right, let's review the Kobayashi Maru questions from episode 12 with Ethan Siegel. Question 1, you're hungry. Dinner from Quarks or dinner by Neelix? Ethan said Quarks, and so did all of you by 73% to 27%. Apparently, you all prefer to be charged retail rates for replicated food. I find this appalling, but you can't always get what you want. But sometimes, you'll get what you need, and that's question 2. You need to take an elective while you're at Starfleet Academy. You can take Stellar Cartography, taught by Nella Darren, or Stellar Phenomena, taught by Dr. Paul Stubbs. My guest selected Stellar Cartography, and so did all of you by 67 to 33%. However, regardless of your voting, Vosh is still a better match for Picard. My official stance on this is of the neener-neener variety. Next question. Any Ferengi with the lobes for business should heavily invest in either Hyperion Beetle Snuff or Hippocat Root Futures. If you recall, Grand Naga Zek was all about the Beetle Snuff, and Ishko was all about the Root Futures. Ethan picked the Beetle Snuff, and you all agreed by 80 to 20%. Apparently, the power of the Nagus compels you. And here we have a ship question, Nebula class or New Orleans class. Ethan picked the Nebula, and so did all of you, by 82 to 18%, a crushing victory for the Nebula. And finally, repeated viewing of which of the following episodes is most likely to make someone get locked up on the Tantalus V penal colony, Aquiel or Code of Honor? Ethan said Code of Honor, and the Twitterverse was in full alignment with him at 80 to 20%. Now, I do have to say, I believe this is the first time that the Twitter people and my guest are 5 for 5 with the exact same answers. That's awesome. Congratulations, Ethan. Be sure to follow me on Twitter, and you can vote in these polls as well and have your say. That's it for announcements. M5, let's roll the interview.
Acknowledged.
Her favorite character is Mr. Spock. Her favorite aliens are the Vulcans. She is a collector of all things Nimoy. Hey, Captain, sensor readings are detecting a theme here. She is from Central North Carolina, North America Earth, in Sector 001. It's Bonnie Moss. Welcome, Bonnie, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate the invitation to be here.
Bonnie, are you a Star Trek fan?
I think so. No, yes, that would be a yes. That would be an absolutely yes. That would be an unequivocal yes.
You sounded a little bit hesitant at first.
Well, perhaps a bit of suspense there for one moment, but no hesitancy whatsoever.
In one of your emails to me, you had made a distinction between being a Star Trek fan and really being a Leonard Nimoy fan.
Yes. Well, I think one kind of segues into the other. I was a Star Trek fan first. Then I became a fan of the character Mr. Spock. And from there, I became a fan of the actor behind Mr. Spock. And then that morphed into following his career and his life and his accomplishments. So it's kind of a layered thing, but I don't see where one supersedes or diminishes the other. So it's all good. Star Trek, Spock, Leonard Nimoy.
Fantastic. Well, we'll get more into that as we go through the podcast, I think. But let's start with just some basics. First of all, have you seen all 700 and something hours of Star Trek?
I have not. I am a TOS original series kind of girl. And I've kind of stayed there, which is not to say I do not appreciate all the other incarnations and other shows. There is room for every one of them, and every one of them brought something different and unique to the table. I have seen sporadic episodes of the other series. I have appreciated their casts, what they had to say, what universe they were in. I think it's all good. I get wary of people who say, oh no, you have to only like this one or that one, or this one is being disrespectful to the other one, or this one's riding on the other's coattails. I think there's room for every one of them.
What's your first Star Trek recollection?
The night it premiered. Yes, John, I'm that old. I was watching television when Star Trek premiered in September of 1966. I do not recall whether or not I had arranged specifically to be in front of the TV during that time. I do remember some of the early promos for the show, but I do recall watching that initial episode and just being grabbed by it from the get-go. And the years I was that Star Trek was on the air and I was watching, I went from age 10 to age 13, which is a huge change in one's life and also kind of, I don't know, your attitude towards the show even changed between 12 and 10 and 13, much less 50 years hence. So that was my first exposure. And it was all new. It was all new, all different. And I don't know that I'll ever have that type of experience again with any other show.
So you mentioned the difference between age 10 and age 13. Talk a little bit about how you feel that your approach to the show changed between those formative years.
I think at age 10, you were looking at eye candy. You know, Star Trek popped in terms of those primary colors. It looked good. And you have to remember that shows were just transitioning from black and white to color during that time. And so initially I was watching TV and everything was in black and white. And I know I'm not alone in that recollection. But, you know, everything from Gilligan's Island to I Dream of Jeannie to the Beverly Hillbillies went from black and white to color. And so you were just fascinated at this process. And Star Trek looked great in color and started out in color, with exception, you know, of the cage. But it visually was stunning to a 10-year-old. And it was almost like getting out your coloring book and having these fantastic shapes and forms and colors. So I think it grabbed me that. And then I was never a big monster person, but it had that element of surprise in those episodes. At 10, you're not getting all the layering that was in so many of the Star Trek scripts. You know, you're getting, oh, this is you know, they're on this planet, and it's you know. So I got some of the other stuff to a degree, but again, 10 in 1966 is like, I don't know, 6 years old today. You know, it was a different time, and people, you know, children weren't as sophisticated or as exposed to things. Fast forward to age 13, now I'm starting to get some of the other, the context, or perhaps some of the other stories. I'm more aware of the Vietnam War. I'm more aware of the news, watching the news. I'm more aware of what Star Trek is saying about prejudice and about, you know, bigotry. You know, the schools are becoming integrated here. I'm in the Deep South. So it became more relevant in other areas as well. And at 13, you're beginning to notice how attractive some of the cast members are. You know, Kirk's a handsome guy. Spock is literally a source of great attraction. So at 10, you're not thinking along those lines. At 13, you are. So again, it was a combination of things during those 3 years.
So you were one of those lucky families that happened to have a color TV in 1966.
Yes, we did. And people would come from, you know, different parts of the neighborhood to come watch certain shows. And of course, color TVs back then, they were a piece of furniture. They took up a whole corner of your den. They were consoles. And so we were very fortunate to have a color TV. And it was an event when we purchased it, or when my father purchased it. People came from other parts of the neighborhood to see it. Now, of course, by the time I was 13, 3 years later, the majority of people had color TVs by then. In 1966, not so much, because again, there was not a reason to get a color TV because the shows were in black and white. So all of this happened, you know, very, very quickly.
I'm always reminded of the current controversy with Star Trek Discovery being on a pay service. And people are thinking that this is, you know, clearly not correct and not appropriate. And I think back to TOS and the whole color palette of the show. And the reason those colors were so poppin' was because they wanted to showcase Star Trek to sell color TVs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there were ads, and I have some of them, and I'm sure some of them have been posted, where the color TV ads are featuring stills from Star Trek. Absolutely. I like to say it helped.
So I'd like to maybe go chronologically with you for a little bit. So the show was on the air from 66 to 68 or 69, and then there was an interregnum of pretty much nothing, at least until the animated series came about. So what if any, connection did you have to Star Trek after TOS went off the air?
It, of course, went into syndication at that point. And luckily, a lot of the channels in my viewing area, and of course, there were only 13 channels then, only as many channels as you could get on your dial. So we were fortunate in that in my area, a number of the stations picked up Star Trek in syndication. So even though I wasn't reserving that time on Thursday or Friday night, you could catch it on a Saturday afternoon. You could catch it on a Sunday afternoon. It tended to be on weekend afternoons. Of course, it was up to the individual affiliate, I imagine, when to broadcast it. But so on the weekends, I could still get a Star Trek fix. So in a way, of course, a lot of people came to the original series through the syndication as opposed to, you know, its original broadcast. So I was able to see these episodes again and again. And there was always talk about, you know, would there ever be a movie based on this? That hubbub was going on for years and years before, you know, it actually became a reality. Of course, there was no internet. There was no social media back then. If you were a Star Trek fan, you met other Star Trek fans through joining the fan clubs of the actors, of writing to the magazines or studios to ask them if they had any, you know, plans for Star Trek. They'd usually send you some token thing in return. But it was essentially word of mouth and pen pal agent, you know, postings that would be in the fan club magazines. I was a member of the Leonard Nimoy fan club, for example, basically from its inception. And so you would get addresses in those yearbooks and newsletters of other fan clubs. And so, you know, you spent a lot of, you know, you had to ask the parents for stamps to stay in touch with your other Star Trek friends, and then you would start mailing stories you would write to each other, and you would mail articles that you may have found to each other. And so that kind of was a very grassroots, very rudimentary, but it, you know, it kept the home fires burning.
So it sounds like you had a relatively solitary experience watching Star Trek, or did you watch it with your family originally?
No, my family was not very science fiction and oriented, and that's probably an understatement, but they could see my passion for it, and therefore, unless there was something else they really, really wanted to watch, I usually got to watch it. I have one brother, older brother, who again was not very interested, but I had the girlfriends from school who would come over, and we would watch it, particularly on weekends. So I would have several of my female friends with me. It's actually amusing in that there was a time when male Star Trek fans thought that women or girls were not into it. I was just the opposite. I didn't know that there were guys into it because we always watched it with other, you know, female friends, you know. So we were very much into it. So it was through friends, not the family, that I would be watching it.
So you were a member of the Leonard Nimoy fan club. Did you engage in any of those pen pal activities and stay in touch with other fans that way?
Yes. Yes, that's how I met a number of other fans. That's how I got to know, you know, I was segueing into Star Trek was no longer on the air, but the fan club featured Leonard Nimoy in the other projects he was doing, some of the plays he was doing at the time, some of his guest appearances on other shows. His people forget he did 2 years on Mission Impossible after Star Trek. So you were doing that type of thing. And so, yes, there was a lot of letter writing in those days.
When the animated series came on, were you aware of it at all?
I was. I was very curious about it. I do remember watching it. I was happy that it was developed and aired because, again, it kept Star Trek in the forefront. And I could recognize, okay, the fact that they're even doing this means that there's some acknowledgement that Star Trek, that there's an interest, that the interest is still out there for Star Trek. We can't give you this right now, but we can give you that. What it meant to me primarily was, okay, this is a signal that we still may see more Star Trek in a different incarnation in the future. You know, somebody's recognizing there's a market out there, even if this is being pitched to kids. And aha, the kids that might be, you know, first exposed to Star Trek through the animated series may start going over and watching the live version. And here we go, more fans, more support. It's going to get us somewhere. In terms of favorite episodes of the animated, that would have to be, you know, yesteryear, because again, very Spock-centric. Talked more initially about his childhood, kind of picked up on what was alluded to in Journey to Babel.
Yeah, and we got to see his amazing pet Saylot.
Exactly, which was cool, pretty cool.
For a second, I thought you were going to suggest the Lorelei signal where all the ladies take command of the Enterprise and save all the men.
That would probably be my second favorite. Yes,
fantastic.
That's right up there, John.
Fantastic. So after animated series, there's sort of another interregnum, and then there's rumors, and there's lots of discussion. But then in the wider world, there's a lot of other science fiction that seems to really take off, right? There's mm-hmm. Star Wars, which comes out in 77, which is always, I think, mischaracterized as sci-fi. I think it's more fantasy than sci-fi, but certainly it's sci-fi adjacent, I think.
Right.
And Close Encounters of the Third Kind also came out during that period of time. And also in the late 60s, 2001 A Space Odyssey came out, which, by the way, it's mind-blowing to realize that 2001 was actually shot at the same time that Star Trek was on the air. And you put those two things together, and it seems like impossible to comprehend, but that was true. So,
wow, yeah.
Did you have any thoughts about these other things that were happening in the sci-fi universe, or did you remain pretty much devoted to Star Trek?
No, I saw each of those films when they premiered, probably the first week that they were released, and had an appreciation for all of those films. I do enjoy science fiction as a genre, and I was of an age when you could go to a lot of movies and do it. Well, I should be speaking for myself in terms of people still go to a lot of movies and everything, but there was more time, it seems, before you are engrossed in your career and family obligations and things like that, where I went to the movies more often. And no, I enjoyed all of those incarnations. And I agree with you. You know, is it science fiction? Is it speculative fiction? Is it fantasy? Is it space opera? Is it, you know, there's so many different words you could use for some of those films. But I appreciated them all. But again, in the back of my head, it was like, okay, we're seeing more science fiction or fantasy or just otherworldly offerings out there. Now, this has got to lead to, you know, you were the eternal optimist, even when you didn't know what you didn't know, hoping that that Star Trek would make an eventual return.
Did the discussions around Phase 2, Star Trek Phase 2, and all of the pre-production and all of that, I'm sure that there were some elements of fan magazines that probably talked a little bit about it. Did any of that get on your radar?
It did, and I need to go through boxes and boxes of old newsletters that I used to get from, I can't remember if was it called Interstat, or it was, there were a number of old newsletters that came out that you could subscribe to, and I really need to go through these boxes where Phase 2 was discussed quite a bit. And I remember one of them, I just remember the logo. It had a logo that mimicked the Paramount mountain, and it said, "This is not a mountain. These are the letters. This is a pile of letters asking for a return of Star Trek." And that image stayed in my mind. Every time I see that mountain and the Paramount logo, I'm like, okay, that's a stack of letters to Star Trek, asking for Star Trek's return. So I do remember it was, again, on a fan level through some of the newsletters that would come out, and I wish to goodness I could remember more of those fan letters' names. And as I say, I have them in different boxes, and I'm sure someone like Larry Nemechek could tell you what the fan clubs and publications were during that time. I'll take this opportunity to say, if anyone is ever in North Carolina and wants to go through a ton of old Star Trek stuff and help me organize it, they are welcome to do so. I feel like I have things in closets and under beds and in drawers, and I've had some of it organized and then other parts of it not so much. And these old newsletters and publications or in that grouping.
Oh, it sounds like a wonderful time capsule of fandom history.
Yes, yes. Larry Nemechek has referred to it as a fallow time, you know, when there was no active Star Trek going on for long periods, yet these publications and the letter networking kind of just kept the embers, you know, hot for an eventual flame.
And then we move into a period where they announce Star Trek the Motion Picture. What are your recollections of that time?
I think it was, you know, of course, there's the tendency for us to go, victory is mine. You know, that's pretty much how you felt, you know, victory. You know, this is, you know, they said, oh, no, never happened. They never bring it back. They never make TV shows into movies. Ha ha. You know, how times have changed. And so you had this sense of victory. And I had an appreciation for, I went premiere night in this area with several friends, male and female, and we had an appreciation for the movie. We didn't have a passion for the movie. And I still appreciate Star Trek the Motion Picture for several reasons. But you didn't leave passionately. You left, okay, it's back. You know, it was well done. Long on special effects, not so much on character, and that's been widely acknowledged. So we were happy it was here, but you didn't leave the theater pumped, but you left the theater gratified.
It's a very Vulcan word, gratified.
Yes, it was, you know, you don't want to say disappointment, you know, how could you be disappointed? But it wasn't the Star Trek you would hope to see, although it had elements here and there. And we were hoping, just hoping it made enough money to want to have them want to do it again. And of course, initially, the feeling was we're not going to do this again, you know, by the studios and, you know. And so it was like, well, we at least proved them wrong that it was never going to happen on the big screen. And then, of course, when we did hear, in fact, there was going to be another motion picture, you know, we were like, okay, hope springs eternal. And for Star Trek II, we left the theater can you be weeping and pumped at the same time? But that was a whole emotional experience that we had been hoping for with the first one. It was all there in the second one on every level.
Well, I just want to say one thing about Star Trek The Motion Picture before we move on, which is I do think it contains possibly the biggest Spock moment in all of the films, depending on how you approach it, which is when he decides that he doesn't want to be a fully cold-blooded, logical Vulcan. He wants to embrace, pardon this terrible pun here, but the best of both worlds and become a Vulcan-human hybrid and live the fullest experience of both parts of his nature.
And I would agree with that. And that is one of those elements that we felt were, and thank you for pointing that out, that we felt were planted, you know, in the movie that we hoped would be, you know, picked up again on or expounded on in future films. But no, that's a very good point. And although you still saw a primarily stoic Spock, even in the later films, there was, as you say, at least there was some acknowledgement that that decision had been made. And we always knew Spock had an internal life that wasn't logical, or that wasn't all logical. And so here was at least some outward acknowledgement of that. So agreed.
The Motion Picture comes out. We go into Star Trek II, which you talked about. Do you want to say anything else about Star Trek II?
I think so much has been said about Star Trek II that there isn't too much I can add to that. I will say I did have the opportunity to meet Nicholas Meyer and talk with him at a reception at one point, and he's a very interesting, very intelligent, very interesting fellow. But he, I think, he knew he had a good film. I think he was even a bit blown away by, you know, the response it had. I think he knew he had a good film. I think he knew he had a hit. But the fact that that film became iconic in terms of the Star Trek films in general, I think took him a little by surprise. But in our conversation, the biggest takeaway was, and I think this has been printed elsewhere, but it was funny hearing it directly from him, the blankets that were featured in the movie, the Starfleet blankets that were on the bunks, he had pushed tremendously to market those. And he had essentially been told, oh, there's not going to be a market for that. We're not, no, nobody's going to buy something like that. And of course, you're thinking, are you kidding me? You know, but he was told, nope. And then, of course, he felt quite vindicated later when Star Trek merchandising was, you know, exploded, and you could put Star Trek on a helmet, you know, and it would sell. When we were saying goodbye at this reception, I said something like, are you still working on getting those blankets marketed? And he laughed and he said, always, always, you know, and was very emphatic about that.
But now,
very
when was this?
Pardon?
When was this? Because I want to understand, was this like roughly when the film was coming out that you met Nick?
This was many years later.
Okay.
This was probably, I'm guessing 5-6 years ago. He was at a local appearance where the film was being screened here in North Carolina. And he was here accompanying The Wrath of Khan being screened at one of those old motion picture restored movie houses here in North Carolina. And there had been a reception prior to the screening for individuals who signed up for it and did certain things. And so we were able to sit down at a table with a few other people and talk with him for a while. One reason that it had attracted him to come to North Carolina to do this, and I don't know whether this is still the case or not, his brother teaches or taught at the time film editing at the North Carolina School of the Arts. So it was a trip to come see his brother here in addition to screening this film and having this reception.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if his brother still teaches there, but the North Carolina School of the Arts initially was the first state-supported school of the arts in the nation. State-supported now, not private, not affiliated with any other entity. It has now segued into being part of the University of North Carolina system. Of course, the main campus, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, but it is now considered another campus, but it is a full-fledged totally focused only on the arts, drama, editing, filmmaking, screenwriting, etc. And so, again, he came to see his brother who taught there and also had this screening and reception. And I have other notes that I took while I was speaking with him. And I can send you a photo of the two of us talking. And I just need to reclaim them to find out what other things, you know, he said about that time. I do remember, of course, asking him about Leonard Nimoy, and he indicated he was extremely bright and that he was involved. He said no matter what he was doing, whether it was playing Spock or calls or even in making suggestions in terms of how he interacted with you, and he was involved. He kept going back to that word.
During the 70s, did you go to any conventions?
I did. My first convention was probably in 75, which is pretty early. What was the one in New York? Was that 73? The one that was kind of the breakthrough. But I started going to conventions in 1975, 75, 76, which puts me in like late high school, early college during that time. I went to initially the smaller conventions because that's kind of all there was, I should say, regional conventions, where you might have one star from the show or one writer from the show. And I'm talking about conventions in Greensboro, North Carolina, Roanoke, Virginia, smaller venues. It was a different time. You know, this convention might cost you $8 to get into. But it was at these small, early conventions that I met Theodore Sturgeon, that I met David Gerrold, that I met initially George Takei, Walter Koenig, Jimmy Doohan. They would do these smaller conventions, and it was a different time. There were no bodyguards. There was no security. You know, you sat down on sofas in a lounge, you know, between their lectures or their presentations, and really got to chat with these people. And, you know, it was a great, great time. I met, and again, at a small, Lee Brackett, who ended up writing The Empire Strikes Back. And so, you know, I have great memories of those times. I think the first larger convention I went to was in Atlanta, Star Trek Atlanta, and that would have probably been in 78, 79. And that had more than one star. William Shatner was there. Jimmy Doohan was there. I want to say Walter was there too. And it was at the Atlanta Hilton. And so it was on a little, you know, it was on a larger scale. But once again, you had, with Shatner possibly being the exception, again, more accessibility, you know, to the guests. And it was more of a familial, you know, atmosphere. It's starting to become a business. It hadn't become big business yet. And then larger still, I attended my first convention out of the region in 1979. And this was in New York. And this was, I think, at the Stadler Hilton. This was right before the first movie was released. So a lot of buzz. They had a lot of the promotional materials for, you know, the motion picture. That's the convention where I met Isaac Asimov. I think it was Walter. I think Michelle was at this one. I think there was some NASA folks there. So that was when I was like, wow, this is a thing. And it just became a bigger thing as time went on.
I'd have to think about it more carefully, but I think I may have actually been at that one.
No kidding.
Yeah, I had my mom take me, and I had her taking me to conventions when I was 7 and 8, 9 years old, until I got old enough to go on my own.
Right.
And, you know, she wasn't a Star Trek fan, although she had watched it when it was originally on, and my father would walk in the room, she tells me, and my father would walk in the room and go, what are you watching? You know? But, you know, she was happy to support me and take me, but when I was too young to go into the city by myself, so.
Right.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't know if I was at that particular one, but it's quite possible I was.
Yes. Well, instant karma, huh?
That's amazing.
So, And it was a good convention. It was a good convention. And I look back on some of the things I purchased in the dealer's room back then, and you know, it was, you know, get your 8x10 glossy photos for $5, you know, get your, and I still have a lot of the stuff I purchased in the dealer's room. And I'm like, of course, 2020 hindsight, why didn't I buy more of this? You know, you can't even find this stuff now, much less at those prices. But of course, you must adjust for inflation. And I was a student and didn't have a lot of discretionary income. But yeah, good times.
One of the things I bought, and it might have been at that convention or something right around that time, was I bought a open box, which in retrospect, I can't believe I bought this, but it was an open box Ertl Star Trek Enterprise Bridge model kit.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it was the whole plastic pieces, and it came with a little Kirk and Spock, you know, and I don't remember who else it came with, but it came with a bunch of figures that you could paint, and it was the full bridge model. You know, you could glue all the sections together and get as detailed as you want. And, you know, and I, for the life of me, I have no recollection of where that ended up. I don't think I would have voluntarily gotten rid of it, but maybe my parents in one of their purges of the storage room got rid of it when I was growing up. I don't know whatever happened to it. I still kind of regret that. I don't know where it went.
Oh, that was going to be my next question, you know, and where is it now? But
I wish I knew.
We've all been victims of the parent purges.
So you had a great time at a lot of these conventions. And then in the early 80s, you heard about some convention that was down in Houston you decided to go to, apparently.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Houston Con and affiliated with it was what was called the Ultimate Fantasy. And this was the first time that a convention was touting the entire cast. Now, it's a whole different can of worms. Leonard Nimoy was in and he was out and he was in and he was out. And so that's just another sidebar. Ultimately, he was out, but then at the last minute asked to be in. Again, another sidebar. But Houston Con 1982 and the Ultimate Fantasy, this was a convention that said, we're getting the whole cast back together. Now, that became less of a thing or of an event later on. But this had not been done. This had not been done. Other, you know, the smaller conventions or the conventions cross country that were happening around the same. Again, you could get one star. You could get two stars. Maybe three. Maybe. The entire cast, that was not unbelievable. You could not, you know, that had never been done. So this created a great deal of buzz. I do remember it being in some of the publications at the time. I'm trying to think if it was the Communicator or something even beyond that, ahead of that, where there were ads for this. And again, I was in graduate school at this point and just felt like, well, this is the only time this is going to happen. Again, you're not, you know, the creation years were not quite upon us nationwide and on the scale that they became. So I immediately made plans to go to this because, and Kirstie Alley was going to be there. Star Trek II was out. And they had mentioned Harv Bennett was going to be there. Well, I knew enough to know that, you know, this was the guy who, in many people's opinion, saved Star Trek because of the success of the second movie. And so I was like, I got to go to this. So made the arrangements to go down to Houston. Oh, I remember it being so hot. I won't go into great detail about this because Larry Nemechek has been working on a documentary regarding this convention called The Con of Wrath, which is how this Houston Con came to be known due to some of the disastrous and wonderful things that happened during this convention. It ended up being grossly mismanaged. People ended up going down there having prepaid for hotel rooms that were no longer available. Not only did they not have their money, there wasn't a room. There was no money to pay the stars to be there. It was, and again, before social media, you were down there in a lobby with 100 other people, not knowing where you were going to spend the night. No means of finding out what's really going on here. Long story short, I ended up getting a room with three other women, all of us putting our lot together to try to, again, pay for one that we had already paid for. But needless to say, it could be summed up that convention as the best of times, the worst of times. It was a huge convention disaster on one level, and on another level, it is sometimes credited with where true Star Trek fandom in action was born. That is, fan helping fans, strangers helping strangers, becoming strangers no more. I'm highly anticipating Larry's documentary, again called The Con of Wrath, that outlines this. Larry was at this convention. Of course, he was much younger and we didn't know each other then. He has interviewed, in fact, got one of the last interviews, if not the last, with Harv Bennett regarding this experience, and has also interviewed Walter and George and Wendy Doohan and I think some of the promoters, as well as other guests, myself being among them. So I would go to LarryNemechek.com or ConOfWrath.com to find out more about this. And Larry has been doing a fundraiser for several years. He's pulled to so many different projects. He's been on this and then had to go off of this due to other commitments. We're hoping that 2019 will be the year for its release. And I'm as intrigued as anyone who wasn't there because I don't know the full backstory as to what went wrong here. And he has the whole story, and I think it will be a fascinating documentary on this point in time, as well as fandom in general.
And we'll put links up to all of that on the show notes page at Trek Profiles. So just in case anyone's looking for that, we'll post links to all of those things. In addition, we'll post some of the great pictures that Bonnie has sent me as well. So we'll have all that up there for all of you. So wonderful. So that takes us through maybe Star Trek II, and then we go into, we'll call them the remainder of the TOS era films. We have Star Trek III, IV, V, VI. Does anything stand out for you at that time period that we should talk about?
Just that it was a wonderful time to be able to anticipate a Star Trek movie roughly every 2 years. That frequency was, I think, beyond expectations. And I remember being very grateful that the entire cast, of course, with some negotiations, hung in for that. And I think they laid down some fantastic work and stories and characters during that time. I remember being immensely moved at the end of Star Trek VI, when literally at the close of the film, their signatures come up one by one. I mean, they're literally and figuratively signing off. And that was, I just remember being incredibly moved by that and recognizing the gravity of that moment, that it truly was the end of the, you know, the TOS era, so to speak.
So in 86, they announced Next Generation was in development and it premiered in 87. Did you watch it? Did you decide to give it a pass? How did you respond or react to it?
I was skeptical that it was going to be successful, as several people were. Not negative, just wondering, not saying, oh, we can't have another, if it's not the original Star Trek, forget about it. That wasn't my take on it. My take on it was, how flexible are people going to be in accepting really a different kind of Star Trek, one with the same ideals and the same camaraderie, I think, that made the first one so special, but completely different. And so I just remember being curious. Again, I won't say negative, but curious. I watched TNG intermittently, and that was not really by any design or any reflection of my opinion of it. I just had other things going on in my life at that time, again, school, career, other obligations. Didn't watch much TV at all during those years, so it wasn't TNG in particular. But I had great admiration for how it did engender a lot of loyalty, and the same type of loyalty and regard that came with the first series. And of course, it ran much longer than the first series. How many years did it run, John?
Seven.
Seven. So more than double, you know, the amount of time of the first series. So I have great admiration for it, and think it served a larger purpose, and that, again, it kept Star Trek in the hearts and minds and the culture. And a lot of people became aware of Star Trek through the Next Generation and then backed up to the original series. So That's all good. That's all good. And some people will say, well, next gen was better than the original. You know, apples and oranges. You know, of course, certainly the special effects and the technology and everything had grown tremendously between the two. And so, I really don't think you can make a lot of comparisons on so many levels. But what it did that was great was that it found a great cast. It found it recognized very early that it's about the relationships as much as it is about the environment. And so I give it great props for that. And, well, it brings to mind when I met Theodore Sturgeon, those many years ago, that would have probably been in the early 80s. We talked for a while. He was very unassuming, very quiet kind of fellow, although he may not have been in other environments, but when we talked, he certainly was. But in his lecture during that time that I saw him, it was at one of these small conventions, he said, and it always stuck with me, future science fiction will be more about inner space than outer space. And I was like, you know, that has come to mean more and more to me as time goes on. So I think one thing that Star Trek, that is such a draw and meaningful with Star Trek, is that it does explore that inner space.
I think that's quite a profound concept. And it's something that I think that if you analyze a lot of Star Trek episodes, there's much more about introspection and about asking ourselves tough questions about our own personal humanity and about humanity more broadly than necessarily about going out into space and, you know, pew, pew, pew and robots and, you know, spaceships and all of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What does this experience mean to us as humans? What does this experience mean to us if we're not human? What does, you know, exactly what you're saying, you know, what are the implications for mankind or universe kind?
Best guess, Bonnie, and I realize I'm putting you on the spot here, but just take a rough guess. Between TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, what percentage of that do you think you've seen? Half of it? Most of it? Two-thirds?
25%.
Ah, okay. And have you seen the J.J. Kelvin Universe films?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes, I've seen all of those. Mm-hmm.
Now, as a hardcore TOS fan, what was your reaction?
And this hesitancy is only to find the most appropriate word, but I'm not coming up with anything better than I liked them. I thought they were well done. I thought they were a great homage to what came before. I thought they were impeccably cast. The first movie, you know, in 2009 in particular, again, opening night, I didn't want to hear what other people had to say or what be colored by it. Anyway, I was blown away. I thought it was extremely well done. I liked the backstories they put to these characters. I thought the script was quite good. I liked how they introduced the characters. I remember reading later, and we didn't touch on it very much, but Leonard Nimoy mentioned that, you know, he wept during a lot of that film, because it resonated with him so much. He even felt the characters were spot on and what they and appreciated the backstory and how they came together and how these bonds of loyalty were formed. So I would say of the three we've had so far, the first one is probably still my favorite, although I certainly liked many elements from the second and third ones.
The one thing I always think about whenever the Star Trek 2009 movie comes up in conversation is I always wanted to know more about Captain Rabaul, that very first captain who's only around for that first few scenes. And I kept wondering, like, I wanted more of that guy. I wanted more of his stories. I liked the actor a lot, and I liked just sort of the presence he had as the captain. And I just kind of wanted more of him. I hope that there's novels or something out there, and people will point them out to me if there are. But I thought he was a really interesting guy.
No, I agree. Yes, we lost him too soon. And of course, that was unfortunately necessary to move the story into Kirk assuming command. But I agree. I hope there is some fiction out there about this guy. He certainly had the courage and the fortitude and the same type of self-sacrifice that seems to be there in all of our captains to some degree.
Have you watched Discovery at all?
Very little. And again, I mean, the people out there now going, and she's a Star Trek fan? Really? Seriously? Again, TOS girl, but with respect and admiration for all that came later. I do not have CBS All Access. I'm okay with there being a charge for CBS All Access. The individuals that have complained bitterly about that are the same ones who would spend, you know, hundreds of dollars in a dealer's room on something that may not be as useful ongoing in terms of laying down a legacy and laying down a story and things like that. But I just have not taken that step. I did watch the first episode, well, the first half of one episode, I guess you could look at it that way, and was very pleased with what I saw. I have done a lot of reading on Discovery. I really don't have any explanation for it. I think that will happen. I do have a means to look at the episode via some other fan assistance. As you learn, John, I'm not a real technical oriented person in terms of getting things off Amazon or off of other platforms and everything. I'll get there. I know a lot about the characters, again, from talking to friends of mine and seeing what's posted and doing that kind of reading. Big, and I don't know if I'm entitled to say this, not having seen everything, but from what I've read and what I've seen in magazines and online and everything, big fan of Captain Lorca. I mean, wow. I mean, that's, and of course, I know things ended up changing quite a bit with this character, and I won't use space at this point for it, but I think Jason Isaacs was cast quite well, and I think that's a real, one of the great characters to come out of Discovery thus far. And he's also great on Twitter. I mean, I follow him, and he just put some great stuff out there. He's obviously a guy that's very smart, who has a social conscience, who's capable of being silly. So he's my biggest takeaway from Discovery thus far.
I would characterize his Twitter stream as quite spicy.
Yes, yes, that's a good word for it. I mean, you either like it or you don't. I think he's very entertaining.
Have you ever worn a Star Trek uniform?
Never. I have never. Again, have great admiration for those who do and whose creativity, oh my gosh, knows no bounds. Interestingly enough, when I first started attending conventions, it was the masquerade contest. It was couched in masquerade. When I first started seeing cosplay, I'm like, what is that? And then I'm like, oh, masquerade. You know? It's just funny how the words for things change over the years, you know. And I think I'm okay with the demise of masquerade, but it's interesting how these things change over the years. But no, I've never felt drawn to do that. I think I just enjoy what other people are doing, and I think it's a great way of kind of becoming part of a whole when you do that. And I do enjoy seeing what folks come up with at conventions.
So no costumes or anything like that, but Spock ears even or anything like that? T-shirts?
Well, I'll confess, I haven't worn them, and I don't think I would, but I do have a pair of the original Spock ears with a signed certification from Leonard Nimoy, and Leonard Nimoy had them. He facilitated my getting them through another intermediary. And so I have the real deal, but I don't think I'll take them out of the frame and put them on. Now, again, I may not have dressed up in costume or done cosplay or anything, but I have like three drawers of Star Trek T-shirts and probably two drawers of Leonard Nimoy-related T-shirts. So I do my thing just on another level.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. So let's actually take this opportunity then to pivot a little bit and actually talk about your involvement with Leonard Nimoy. So you were in his fan club.
Yes.
For a period of time. And Leonard, you know, was a real polymath. I mean, the guy was into so many things. One of my earliest convention memories of him was him reading his poetry, which he was really big into at one time. And he would do readings at the conventions. And that was one of the first times I'd seen him live, was him doing that. Talk a little bit about how you got involved with his art and tell us what happened there.
Okay. Well, I first saw Leonard Nimoy lecture, as you were saying, reading his poetry and everything, in 1976. Was in college at the time, and he was doing a lot of college dates during that time, and got to see him and Gene Roddenberry on several occasions doing their college tour thing, and then, as I say, sometimes talking to them at receptions before, after. I, as I explained earlier, I became a Star Trek fan, then a Spock fan, then a Leonard Nimoy fan. So started following his career and met him for the first time in 1979, which blows my mind. That's 40 years ago, or almost 40 years ago. And this was when he was doing a play that he had adapted from a narrative and directed and starred in, one-man show called Vincent, and it was regarding the life of Vincent Van Gogh. And he played Theo, or Theo Van Gogh, Vincent's brother, and essentially the one-man show is him eulogizing his brother, with the backdrop being a montage of Vincent's paintings. Was able to, and I won't go into great detail. This was in Washington, D.C., and a friend of mine and I had gone up there because we wanted to see Leonard Nimoy on stage, aside from the lecture circuit. It was a wonderful play, wonderful experience. In fact, our very first meeting was in the lobby, and I had one of his poetry books with me. And again, I can flesh out details if and when I meet any of you folks out there. But he was pleased that I had asked him to sign his poetry book. We talked for several minutes in the lobby, and he appreciated that we had come up from North Carolina to Washington to see the play. That afternoon, my friend and I, and maybe two other women, we went around to the back of the theater to just see where the stage door might be, where he might come out after the show to get autographs or speak with him or something. Well, we were kind of messing around, and it started to rain, and we're like, oh, gosh, we're going to need to go back to the lobby. Now we know where the stage door is, that type of thing. And the door opened, and we knew we were going to be shooed away. But the door opened, and it was Leonard. And he looked out and said, what are you guys doing here? And we said, oh, well, we were seeing the stage door, so we might see you later. He went, but you're going to get wet. Don't stand out here and get wet. Come on back. So he took us all backstage, and we had a wonderful time and talking, and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I can't recall if it had just come out or was about to come out, and we talked about that, and I had him actually sign a still from Body Snatchers. Again, this was pre-social media. This was not eBay. This was not on anything. I had written a studio to heard Leonard Nimoy was going to be in this film. Will you send me some? It was a different time. Studios and magazines would just send you stuff. And he looked at it, and he went, wow, he had not seen this still of him from Invasion of Body Snatchers. And he said, where'd you get this? And I said, I wrote the studio for it. And he went, really? And he held on to it for the longest time. And I learned over the years later that when he held something for a long time, he wanted it. And so I learned later on to say, Mr. Nimoy, would you like this? Yeah, yeah, that'd be great, you know. So, but at this time, I didn't know that. He signed it, autographed it. Again, we talked. That was the first meeting. We hit it off. I will keep going and just say over the next several years, we met several different times. I did get to see him and Vincent in Atlanta a year or two later. Was able to go backstage then. We talked some more. I was now working as a therapist on an inpatient psychiatric unit. He signed autographs for the patients. He signed autographs for the unit I was working on. We had a wonderful conversation. I got to know one of his assistants at the time by the name of Eric Harrison. It was a process. It was a process. Then in the mid-80s, he did another lecture swing. We got to, again, talk for some time. I actually snuck in one of the press conferences at this particular lecture where it was press only. He knew I wasn't with the press. He was sitting in a chair during this interview with the press and kept looking over and laughing because he knew I wasn't with the press. And he was pointing like, do you want to ask a question? And I was horrified because I didn't want any attention drawn to me. But it was incidents like that that persisted for several years. I may not be going fast enough for you here, John, but it was a process. It wasn't overnight.
It's fine.
In 2000,
it's fine.
Pardon?
You're fine.
Oh, okay. Thank you. appreciate that. In 2009, I went to a convention in Boston called the New England Fan Experience. It was not a huge convention, which was great. Again, because he was going to be there, I knew his being in Boston was going to have extra meaning for him. And in fact, it was at this convention that I think the city of Boston actually instituted Leonard Nimoy Day and presented a certificate to him. During this convention, and again, I'm making a long story short, I was wearing one of his t-shirts with one of his photographs on it that had been sold through, I think, his granddaughter, Danny, and perhaps it was through Etsy at the time. He noticed I was wearing this shirt, and he asked me to come on stage. And so I came on stage, and we had a pretty big laugh that I won't go into it, but he started explaining about talking about his photography and the picture I was wearing and what that meant. And then he mentioned that he was going to have his first major photography exhibition at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, MassMoCA, the next year. And that it was going to be regarding a theme of his called Secret Selves, which he was going to photograph people asking them to present as the self. What is their secret self? What is it that you keep hidden or that you aspire to or that, and present as that person or that being, and I will take your photograph. Well, I was intrigued by this. I thought, this is great. So that's kind of, you know, I'd always been a fan of the photography. Again, I was already wearing one of his t-shirts.
Let me just say one thing, by the way, for my tens of listeners out there, which is there are some great YouTube short videos of the actual event of the Secret Selves photographs actually occurring. So I'll put links up to all that on the show notes page. So they're definitely worth checking out.
Fantastic. Oh, that'd be great, John. Fantastic. So that was how I first heard about Secret Selves. And I had purchased my first Leonard Nimoy photograph when I was 15 through his fan club that we had mentioned earlier. So I, even back then at age 15, and I remember distinctly, I still have the yearbook, Leonard offered these photographs that he took. He took them, he hand developed them, you know, at his home. He matted them himself. He signed them $3 a photo, $3. And so I purchased, you know, a photo, my 15-year-old self, for $3. That photo, incidentally, was recently appraised by a gallery at $2,000. So not a bad investment for a 15-year-old. So I say that to say my interest in his photography went as far back as his fan club. So back up to Secret Selves, and this was very important to him because it was a major exhibition at a major Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. It's the largest museum of contemporary art in the United States. So this was huge. I ended up contacting MassMoCA later, and Leonard and I also had a mutual friend that had mentioned to me that Leonard got the biggest kick out of you at the convention, this New England fan experience. And I said, well, I want to find out about Secret Selves. And so this friend and Leonard both gave me additional information. I ended up calling MassMoCA and saying, will there be any receptions, events, et cetera, related to Leonard's appearance there in this exhibition? And they said, yes, as a matter of fact, there is. There's some sponsorship opportunities. There's a dinner. There's this, this, and this. Well, ultimately, as things played out, I became the primary sponsor of this exhibition, not the sole sponsor, but the primary sponsor in terms of financial commitment and other commitment and involvement and things like that. As such, I got to attend a dinner with Leonard and Susan Nimoy and other sponsors that was on the campus of MassMoCA, and also got to have my portrait taken by Leonard Nimoy, which was another highlight. And of course, during that time, we had the chance to talk again more at length about his artwork. But most importantly, or equally importantly, obviously I had started a collection back in when I was 13, 15 onward of Star Trek, and then, of course, into Leonard Nimoy collecting. I brought some of my collection with me up to MassMoCA, and we were able to spend an hour at least going through my collection. Now imagine being there with Leonard Nimoy, and I'm flipping through just one of many of my scrapbooks and photos, and he's telling me something about each of these things. Oh, I remember that. I did this. I remember so on and so forth. Oh, there was a lovely actor to work with. Oh, this. It was incredible to have that time and to have that portrait and to see Secret Sales, which was just an amazing exhibition and got wonderful reviews and really validated his stature as, you know, an important photographer. That in turn, again, ongoing communication frequently through mutual acquaintances and contacts. I had collected his photography. As I said, I started when I was 15, had purchased several photographs since that time, some of them through a good friend of Leonard's, Rich Michelson, who owns the Michelson Gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts, and who he and Leonard were great friends. I think they emailed virtually every day the last several years of Leonard's life. I had collected enough photographs at that point, and I'm speaking 4 years ago, I guess, that I went to our local arts council and said, would there be any interest in an exhibition here regarding Leonard Nimoy's photography? Luckily, one of their staff members and curators knew about Leonard's photography, knew that he was well known. Leonard also has some of his photography in the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, you know, the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles. He's got works in major museums. So luckily, someone down here said, yes, this is worth it. This is, you know, this is, and we're grateful to have the opportunity to show his work. So I got in touch with Rich Michelson at his gallery. He got in touch with Leonard. The two of them agreed, which was enormous. I mean, these people had stuff in New York and Los Angeles, and, you know, they didn't need North Carolina. You know what I'm saying? But they both graciously said, yes, Leonard gave us permission. This, yes, more than happy that for you to pursue this. Rich Michelson ended up sending 40 more Leonard Nimoy photographs down from his gallery. And we had the exhibition down here that I'm trying to think it would have opened here. It had been, say, Leonard unfortunately passed in February of 2015.
April or May, wasn't it, that the exhibit opened?
Yes. Thank you, John. Yes, it opened in May. And of 2015, it was never meant to be a retrospective, I mean, or a posthumous. It was never meant to be that. But Leonard had given his permission, and of course, he passed away in that February, and the exhibition was open in May. So it was very bittersweet. It truly was the first exhibition of his work since his passing, and that meant a lot to me and helped with my grief process enormously, and Rich Michelson couldn't have been kinder or more helpful with it. The exhibition here was a tremendous success. I ended up sending materials and photographs and press. It was covered by several art-related publications and newspapers and things like that. The biggest compliment I think I received was from Susan Nimoy, who said this exhibition was well done, it was beautifully curated. And Susan Nimoy knows art. She's very much in contemporary art and photography, and she's been on boards of some of these major museums. She said it was very well curated, and then she said Leonard would have loved it. Brava on your success. Love, Susan Nimoy. And that meant the world to me.
I can only imagine as a Star Trek fan how that felt, and I think, even though it's not my place, I'll just say thank you for being involved in all of that and showing another side to Leonard's wonderful work.
Wow, thank you, John. That's high praise indeed. And fortunately, that has been the response of so many people who said, well, I'll always love Star Trek and Spock, but this added another dimension to things. And anytime you can get more art and beauty in the world, you know, why not?
Hear, hear. So the M5 is telling me that there's some episodes we should talk about. I think it'd be a good time to jump into that portion of our discussion.
Okay.
One of the episodes that the M5 has selected for us is City on the Edge of Forever. Why is this episode particularly meaningful to you?
I think the fact that, and so much has been written on this episode, but for me, the fact that it took place on Earth, very relatable. And it was a period of history that adults in the 60s could remember. I mean, this was Depression era Earth, United States. So I think it would be one of the few episodes like my parents might have been interested in because they remembered this era. You know, it wasn't on a foreign planet. It wasn't on another galaxy. It was Earth in the 1930s. So it was this episode's relatable to more people because of that connection there, because it highlights a time that particularly people in the 60s that were watching this for the first time remembered very vividly. The other appeal is it's a tragedy and a love story. It's a love story and a tragedy, both. I mean, it's Romeo and Juliet. It's great romance, great connection, and then ultimately tragedy. Ultimately, it cannot happen. It cannot continue. It cannot be pursued. And so that dichotomy there was very, and is very appealing to me. And I think it interesting that, you know, Kirk has toured the galaxy and met many exotic women and aliens and had his share and princesses and queens. But who does he fall in love with deeply, madly? It's an Earth woman and who is a social worker. You know, it's not, and I just thought, wow. I mean, now you can argue, okay, there was Kirk and Miramani. Well, Kirk wasn't in his usual state. You know, he wasn't himself through much of that. This is Kirk as Kirk. And the person he has probably the most intense romantic commitment to is an Earth social worker. And I thought, wow, that resonated with me. And I don't know if on some subliminal level, maybe that's why I became a social worker. You know, I have my master's degrees in social work. And I think maybe in the back of my head, way back in my head, you know, that's what, that maybe its roots go all the way back to this episode. I think, too, one reason the episode was memorable, again, at the time, is that Kirk's final statement, you know, let's get the hell out of here. Well, again, television at that time, it wasn't a lot of, you know, and I think we're at a point now where we don't even consider hell profanity. But at the time it was, whoa, you know, that gave great gravity to the situation, you know, and to the story for Kirk to say that. And it jumped out because it was not what you expected. And it was not typical for television at that time. It's kind of like, it's the equivalent of Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn. It's Gone with the Wind. The studio, there was so much opposition to that one word at the end, and there was great conflict and it stood out in that film, you know, again, because at that time that was not the norm for major characters to talk like that. So I think for those reasons, City on the Edge of Forever resonates with me.
In fact, the word hell does appear several times in the original series, but this is the only instance where it's actually used as an expletive. In the other cases, it's used as a reference to the, how shall we put it, the domicile of the damned.
Yes, not as an exclamation or as, yes.
But you bring up something else, though, Bonnie, in talking about this episode, which is that Kirk falls for this social worker, right? And it's very much out of line with that sort of Kirk ladies man, always going for these incredible space chicks, you know, I can't think of a better word for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had another guest on who afterwards in some Twitter conversations was making reference to the fact that Kirk's alleged reputation as a ladies man is really quite undeserved. He really isn't that way. And one thing that does have evidence in the primary source material, but isn't really appreciated by people, is the fact that he's actually quite a literary and well-read fellow. And there's an example of that in City on the Edge that jumped out at me, is he's quoting these authors from the future. He, you know, he's talking about, you know, oh, right there at this star, there'll be an author born in 100 years who'll talk about let me help being the three most wonderful words, recommending them above I love you. In Space Seed, when Khan says, have you ever read Milton? And Kirk just doesn't say, yeah, I read Milton. He actually has enough Milton in his head to know what part of it that Kahn is referring to. You have to be a deeply literate guy or person to have those kind of references in your head. And at another point, he's quoting some literary giants of the 20th century. I mean, it really is an interesting take on the character. And there's a nice moment of that in this episode. And I think it goes right along with what you were saying about how he really ends up going for the social worker, right? It's so against the headcanon of what Kirk is that I thought it was really beautiful to point out.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And responding to her kind of visionary, you know, view of mankind in the future, enjoying, he bonds with her optimism as well as in knowing this optimism will ultimately be fulfilled. And so I think, but I agree. And sometimes Kirk's romances were devious in nature to accomplish goal of saving a crew member or the Enterprise. So I agree with you there. Some of that reputation is perhaps not deserved. But I think, and this kind of segues a little bit back to Leonard Nimoy a bit, he always said that he felt the best Star Trek was about the Jewish mitzvah of Tikkun Olam, which was healing the world. We go out into space and we're finding ways. And world being a euphemism for other beings, mankind. You know,
sure,
the universe.
Existence.
Yes, existence. Thank you, John. And this was a case of she was exhibiting Tikkun Olam. You know, she was trying to heal the world, this particular character, with sobriety and hard work and regard for your fellow man. You want to get through these hard times to get to our ultimate goal and reward, you know, that type of thing.
The M5 has selected another episode, which is an interesting contrast to the first one we just talked about. So City on the Edge, of course, has a very beautiful message. But then the M5 says we should now talk about Balance of Terror, which you also identify as an episode that's meaningful to you. But it's very different in tone and I think in message than the first one. So tell me, what about this episode is special to you?
Okay. Yes, one of my favorites. Great performances. I mean, I think Mark Leonard is brilliant in this. The story is so well written in that the adversaries are so adversaries on one level, not adversaries on another level. I mean, there's when you can write something where people start out as adversaries and then proceed or end with not knowing who to root for or wanting both parties to survive, that's an accomplishment in, what, 50 minutes to bring that. Okay, I can see there are honorable people even when their cause may be dishonorable. You know, you really are torn at the end of that episode. You don't want anything to happen to this guy. In the beginning of the episode, they're, you know, marauders, you know. That's good writing. That's good character development. The other thing that stands out for me in that episode is the whole idea of Romulans looking like Vulcans and what that stirs up in at least one crew member in terms of suspecting Spock or wondering, I mean, kind of guilt by association, you know, of this crew member towards Spock. Well, you look like them, therefore you're not to be trusted. And this is one of the more overt episodes or instances where Kirk says, there's no room for prejudice, not here, not on this bridge, not anywhere. I mean, certainly prejudice had been addressed or hinted at in other episodes, but this was hammer over the head. There's no room for it, mister. It's here. Let's call it what this is, and it's overt prejudice. It also plants the idea, the sad idea, that with this crew member, if you look like someone, you just look like something else, you could be a threat. You're potentially unreliable and it could be a threat. Well, isn't that the thinking we had towards the Japanese in World War II when we put them in internment camps, George Takei being among those interred?
Absolutely.
You look Japanese. Therefore, never mind that you were born here, never mind that you've been upstanding citizens, never mind you look Japanese. Therefore, you are not to be trusted. And here you go. It trickles over today. If you have Arab dress or Arab accents, it's once again, well, if you look like this, therefore, or you talk like this, or you dress like this, therefore cannot be trusted because there's an affiliation with something else that looks like you.
That's the stereotype you're referencing.
Mm-hmm. There's an association with something that happened pre-Star Trek, as in World War II, and post-Star Trek in terms of how we look at other cultures and ethnic groups today. So that's very powerful stuff.
One of the reasons that TOS holds a special place in my heart, and I think that latter incarnations of Star Trek have not lived up to this particular legacy, although they've certainly exceeded others. But in this area, I think TOS stands alone in that given the state of society at the time that the show was on the air, they push things further in further, more standard deviations away from where society was on the bell curve than any other Star Trek has. When you think about the mid to late 60s, you think that while Star Trek was on the air, there were literal race riots happening.
Mm-hmm.
And they put an episode on, like, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
RFK was assassinated. And they were talking about these kinds of issues. There were riots in Chicago and during the convention, the DNC convention in 1968. And, you know, police brutality and all that was going on. And when you look at the kinds of things that they were talking about, they were so far beyond where society was at the time that I felt like they pushed that envelope further than I think Star Trek has not done in its more recent incarnations. But I'm happy to engage with people on that. If they want to beat me up, you know, they can tweet at me and, you know, certainly give me examples. I'm open to being proven wrong on that. But I'm pretty well established in that point of view. And there's just a really nice example of that in Balance of Terror. Because as you say, Lieutenant Sulu, George Takei, had that experience. You know, the Korematsu decision that the Supreme Court made in World War II about allowing the internment of American citizens who were of Japanese origin. It was an absolute blight. It was horrible, right? And it was glad to be repudiated in more recent decisions, you know? So that was overall a good thing. So I think that perhaps MLK was right when he talked about the fact that that the arc of history bends towards justice. And it's a good lesson, and I think that Star Trek embraced it fully, and this episode is certainly an example of it.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. It literally, and part of their assertion of this is that the times in which this was initially broadcast were so turbulent, and of course, those could argue that we're hearkening back to those times in the current political environment, but it certainly was an outside-the-box thing to put out there, given the turbulence of the times. But thank God it was put out there.
Tell me about Devil in the Dark and why that's an important episode for you.
Well, it bears some similarities to why Balance of Terror has such meaning, because once again, we're kind of encountering the fear of the unknown, misinterpreting what something is, what they're trying to say, and assuming the worst rather than the best when we encounter something new, not to mention the mob mentality that takes over when you do fear the unknown, or when you don't have enough information about something, or you misinterpret what information you have. And I think that the assumptions, of course, they made in the beginning of the episode, and then what turns out to be the truth are, you know, 180 degrees. But we jump to these conclusions again because people's tendency to fear the unknown. There's always something more than meets the eye. And I'll give you an example from my work. Licensed clinical social worker, I have worked in inpatient psychiatry, outpatient psychiatry, and in the public health sector. And now I'm working with hospice, inpatient and outpatient hospice individuals. But when I was working on an inpatient unit, there was an individual who was brought in for an assessment, and he attempted to jump out the window, and therefore he was considered completely psychotic. We got to restrain this guy. He's trying to jump out of a window. He wants to kill himself. We've got to do all great measures were taken to secure it, and some of the measures taken back when I started out in psychiatry were not pleasant precautions. The assumption was made he's going to kill himself. We have to. The next day, he came in on third shift. I came in on second the next day and was talking to this gentleman. And I'm like, this gentleman isn't psychotic. He truly is not. And I said, it was great worry last evening when you tried to kill yourself. And he said, I didn't try to kill myself. And I said, everyone was saying you were trying to jump out the window to kill yourself. He said, ma'am, I just wanted to leave. I didn't want to be here, and I thought we were on the first floor, not the third. So I was just going to go out the window to run away until I could get my you-know-what together. Well, that's a vastly different interpretation, isn't it, from what everyone assumed what was going on. This guy was not suicidal. He was not a danger to himself or others. He really just wanted to get out of there. There was a window. He had no intention of wanting to hurt himself. He had no intention of, and that's just an example of you assume the worst, not the best, or at least not what might be more likely. You know, they tell medical students, if you hear a stampede, think horses, not zebras. You know, think what might be more likely than what's less likely. And most importantly, just think before jumping to conclusions. And I don't mean to be making a bad joke there. So that always resonated with me. Find out a person's motivation for doing what they do before you just act.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because just amazingly coincidentally, boy, is that an oxymoron? Amazingly coincidentally? I don't know. I'll have to ponder that one later. Write me on Twitter. Let me know what you think. But okay. I was listening to another podcast, totally unrelated to anything sci-fi related. And they were talking about the case of Charles Whitman, who was the shooter at University of Texas back in 1966, who shot all those people from the bell tower.
Yes, yes.
And in his autopsy, they found that the man had giant tumors growing in his brain. And that there's a theory that he may not have even been in control of his actions. His behavior might have been totally an aberration caused by these tumors growing where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it could have been a case where, you know, had the science and the technology existed at the time, had those tumors been taken out, he could have been totally normal.
Absolutely.
And it's just another example of what you're talking about, right? So sometimes these behaviors have causes that are not quite seen.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, sometimes we don't have the wherewithal to get at it or do that, but at least have the thought, at least take what opportunity you do have to see another point of view.
Well, speaking about other points of view, tell me about Mirror, Mirror and the point of view of the Mirror Universe.
Wow. And I will go back briefly to my 13-year-old self. Mirror, Mirror just had kick-ass costumes, and Spock's goatee deserves its own show. I mean, well, there's already a group out there called Spock's Beard, but my 13-year-old self sometimes comes to the fore on that one. I mean, everyone looked great. And Bob could not be sexier than he was with the goatee. Am I getting too highbrow for you?
So is this characterized more as guilty pleasure or deeply profound and meaningful episode?
I would have to say guilty pleasure, followed by a close second, a good episode. I think there were wonderful scenes written and performed by Walter Koenig. I mean, can anyone scream better than Walter Koenig did in this episode in the booth? And great scenes for Nichelle Nichols, flirting with a purpose with the alternate Sulu. I think, again, well written, food for thought. I think it was one of our, and I'm sure you can elaborate or correct me, but this was one of the initial times, I should say, where you saw an alternate universe with the same individual. It was still someone known as Spock, someone known as Kirk, someone known. So you had that alternate universe, but you had the same core characters, but albeit with a different society, environment, purpose. And my goodness, what would Discovery have done for a number of its episodes without the concept of Mirror, Mirror?
if we go down that rabbit hole, I think we'll be here an additional 2 hours because I have many, many, many thoughts about that. But
yes.
I will sum it up in best in this way, mm-hmm. which is that I think the mirror universe works best as a concept, like wasabi mm-hmm. on your sushi. It's best in small doses.
Mm-hmm.
Too much and it overpowers the dish.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think at its best, Star Trek has to be about us.
Yes.
And when you go into the dystopian universe, it's mm-hmm. it makes it a more tenuous connection to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mirror universe is best used as a mirror, not as a primary setting. That's my opinion on it. And that's really all I'll say about it. But
that's a valid opinion. And everyone obviously will have a different take on that. And I do think that's valid. And then going back to, you know, our initial take on the episode, I do think it was a guilty pleasure for me. I do think some other characters had some good acting, were able to exercise some acting chops in this. And again, it was interesting to see these characters in a different frame of mind.
No judgment here, Bonnie. We love the guilty pleasures, and I endorse it completely. Merely on that basis, I think it's a good addition to the list.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to do a twofer and discuss two episodes at once because I think that they both have a strong theme in common, which is your favorite Vulcan, Mr. Spock. Let's talk about Journey to Babel and Amok Time. Certainly two Spock-heavy episodes, certainly episodes that have a lot to do with his Vulcanness and his relationship with his family and all of that. So tell me why these particular episodes, you can do them either together or apart, but tell me why you felt a particular attraction to these episodes.
I think with Amok Time, it was the fact that we saw Vulcan, the planet Vulcan, for the first time and saw other Vulcans in that setting. I think for Journey to Babel, you know, my name for that episode is Meet the Parents. Also fleshes out Spock's culture, Spock's childhood, Spock's history. So, you know, both those episodes, of course, very Spock-centric. I think that with Amok Time, again, it was the episode. I liked the fact that it was a matriarchal society. Guess what? Females can actually be icons and the head of societies, governments, et cetera, et cetera. I liked able to be, to lead. I mean, this was at a time the matriarch of Vulcan was there before there was a female starship captain, you know. So I liked seeing that. And of course, it's well known that this is where the LLAP symbol, hand sign, was initiated. And of course, it was through input from Leonard on this. And he did not explain until sometime later, maybe because he did not anticipate that there would be such curiosity about that, that, you know, its origins were in his Jewish Orthodox roots, and that this hand signal was a blessing from the Jewish priests, the Kohanim. And as presented in the synagogue, it is with both hands. So he kind of adapted that to the situation, but felt it was a greeting that would be unique. And he certainly never saw it taking off as it did, but he felt that there needed to be more than just a verbal greeting in this situation.
Bonnie, I have to ask, can you do the salute with both hands?
I can.
I can't. I'm jealous.
Really? Shatner can't do it with either one.
I can do it perfectly with my right hand, but for my left hand, for whatever reason, my fingers will not join.
Well, what is it that one fan said? I speak it with an accent?
Yeah, sounds perfect.
There was a fan who couldn't do it, and she said, I speak it with an accent. So that's the take I would have on that.
I'm totally going to steal that now.
Okay, good. You know, that hand signal is actually representative of the letter Shin in the Hebrew alphabet. If you look up Shin in the Hebrew alphabet, it looks like this. And Shin is the first letter in Shaddai, which is the Almighty. It is the first letter in Shalom, peace. It is so essentially what people are doing when they do this is they're blessing you. And so, of course, at the time, people didn't know all this backstory, but Leonard once said, I think it's great that people can go out there and bless one another using this. Isn't that a great legacy, you know, from this episode? The other thing with Amok Time that resonated with me is that this was the episode that was in I'd seen it when it was originally broadcast, but it was broadcast on a Sunday afternoon in syndication. During the time I was to write an address, I had been named valedictorian of my high school class. I graduated from high school in 75.
Congratulations.
I've lost a lot of brain cells since then. But and as I say, technology has thrown me for a huge loop. I was great with books and ideas, technology. I'm still behind the curve on that. But anyway, I had to give an address, which I was not thrilled about doing because I wanted to sit with my friends, not on stage. You know, I wanted to have fun. I didn't want to have to, you know, be with the grown-ups. But anyway, so I was putting off writing this address. And a mock time was on. And so I kept going in the other room and watching that and then coming back and writing something and going in the other room and going in. Well, the name of it was finally Survive and Prosper. Because my naive little self said, well, if I use Live Long and Prosper, they may come after me for some copyrights or somewhat, you know. I just felt like I didn't want to be that blatant about it. So it actually inspired my address as a valedictorian. And of course, in the address, I'm just was talking about all the things that we have survived and are as individuals and as a society, and yet we somehow came out on the other end and prospered. And we can do this now as we go forward. Don't plan on just surviving, plan on prospering, yada, yada, yada. Big thoughts for a, 18-year-old? So
that's wonderful.
I always have that connection to that episode.
Bonnie, have you watched the remastered versions of the original series?
I've watched a few of them. I have seen a few of them. The clarity, of course, is amazing. And of course, on my parents' color TV console, you did not see the Band-Aids and the scratches and the arc lights as you do on some of the remastered. But that being said, what were you getting at there?
Well, A Mock Time is one of the episodes that really got some big improvements in the remasters because they added in a lot more scenery on Vulcan, some more establishing shots. If you look at the original series, the original shots was a little claustrophobic for visiting a planet because they were limited to the set and a matte painting.
Mm-hmm.
And they really blew it up in the remastered version. You know, you got a real sense of the size of the place. You got a much more expansive view of the planet. I mean, the episode was really served well in the remaster. So I was just wondering if you had a chance to have seen that and had any thoughts on it.
Well, no, but I will now.
All right. Fantastic. All right. Let's talk about Naked Time. I would categorize this as a guilty pleasure, but do you?
Perhaps a little more than guilty pleasure, but not as important, quote unquote, as some other episodes. I think I appreciated Naked Time then and now because you got to really see what could be part of Spock's emotional core. You know, it was almost a teaser of things to come with Spock. Here he is, you know, again, under the influence, but there were still elements of truth in the emotional catharsis he kind of has in terms of the pain and the anger and the frustration and regrets regarding his mother, what he's able to show and not show. I think it's a masterful performance by Leonard Nimoy, and it wouldn't surprise me if this were not the episode they may have submitted that secured an Emmy nomination for him. Because the range, it's painful to watch, and that's the point. And I think it, again, kind of planted the seeds for, okay, there's a lot under the surface here. You know, you really saw that duality. And so my response to Naked Time is primarily in terms of what this meant for Spock, what this showed us about Spock. And I've wondered later, this kind of inner life, if that didn't somehow later influence Leonard in the Secret Sales Project. Come to us as the person we don't see. Come to Secret Sales. Well, this was kind of Spock's secret self here. So, you know, lo, 40 years later, it kind of crops up in some of his photography.
I think that that's a profound insight, Bonnie. For any listeners out there, if you have an interest, go and read about the Secret Selves photo shoot. And there's a lot of Greek mythology tied into it, this idea that humans originally had four arms, four legs, and two heads, and we were ripped apart into two different pieces by Zeus. And you have your secret self and then your actual self. And that was the point of the whole project, was for Leonard to try to film and capture that secret self. I mean, it really just was a really interesting idea. And I do see the linkage here. And I think that's a really interesting linkage, a really interesting insight. So thank you for that one.
And thank you for making that other acknowledged comparison to Greek mythology. That definitely did factor into it as well.
Bonnie, what does Star Trek mean to you?
It means that there is a future. There is a future where we may not only get along with each other, but with what may lie for us in the unknown as time and mankind and our scientific endeavors, where they may bring us. It's okay to be positive about the future. We're correct in being positive about the future. I think that's a message we desperately need to hear these days. As you mentioned earlier, I remember being sent home from school when JFK was assassinated. I remember the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. I remember asking my mother, and again, before social media, a lot of people weren't aware of the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during that time. Certainly, the Black community was aware of it. Sadly, not so much in the white community. And I remember asking my mother, well, what did he do that was so bad? And, you know, I was 11 and 12, and she said, well, he didn't do anything. And I said, well, what did he do? And she said, well, he was a preacher. He was a pastor. And to me, that was like, and I remember going, why would you shoot a pastor? Why would you shoot a preacher? It just didn't make sense. It didn't make it, still doesn't. But, I mean, at that time, that was like the worst thing you could possibly do would be to shoot a man of the cloth. So, and of course, Vietnam was going on. It did and still does give us a reason to hang in, give us a reason to continue to explore, to continue to better ourselves and where we're at and the goals for where we're going.
Bonnie, it's interesting that you talk about this, and I think you have a very valuable perspective as a fan who's been around for such a long time, and I think it's important for especially younger people, and this goes beyond Star Trek, but I think just younger people in the world to have a sense of some of the recent history. I know that as we record this in 2018, there's a lot of hyperbole that people like to use to describe the current moment. This is the worst it's ever been. It's never been like this. This is the mm-hmm. most horrible moment in American history. And I always find I have to talk people off the ledge with that, because also being a Star Trek fan, I'm also optimistic about the future. The long-term future, maybe not the short-term, but the long-term future. And I often think about the things that you talk about, right? I mean, these assassinations of leaders, which were horrible. I think about things like we once had a senator caned in the U.S. Senate and was given life-changing injuries. I don't think we have anything close to that today. But when Preston Books caned Senator Sumter in the well of the Senate, 23,000 Americans were killed in a single day in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to adjudicate these people's feelings, who have very raw, powerful feelings, against these other things. And for me, I struggle a bit. I struggle a bit to adapt the hyperbole. But I think that one of the things that you've touched on is how Star Trek is a salve in a lot of ways to a lot of that, because
yes.
It sends us a message that things might be bad now, but they'll get better. So don't give up and don't lose hope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Precisely. From a historical perspective, things have ebbed and flowed in terms of, kind of like the Guardian, you know, in terms of time and how we have had the best of times and the worst of times throughout history. And I think it can go back to, yes, human beings have done despicable things to one another and to but it was also human beings thought of Star Trek that still had the capacity to think of this too.
I can't think of a better note to wrap up our podcast today, Bonnie, because the M5 is signaling me that it is now time for the Kobayashi Maru simulation.
Okay.
The Kobayashi Maru is a challenging and difficult test, cunningly prepared by the M5. Should you not only survive the test, but pass it as well, the M5 will award you an honorary Star Trek title. Are you ready, Bonnie?
I am ready.
M5, load the Kobayashi Maru simulator and prepare to record Bonnie's responses.
Simulation ready.
Question one. It's dinner time. Will it be Riley's blue and orange food cubes or Kelvin nutrition pills?
Kelvin nutrition pills.
Let's take a tour of a lost civilization. Would you rather visit planet Sarpedion or planet Charon?
Planet Charon.
Which of these is your least favorite? The alternative factor, the Omega Glory?
Alternative factor.
Who is the bigger space hustler, Harry Mudd or Cyrano Jones?
Cyrano Jones.
Which is more terrifying, the M113 salt sucker or the Denevan neural back parasites?
The salt sucker.
Simulation complete. M5, please compute the results and tell us if our guest has passed the Kobayashi Maru.
Calculating results.
Bonnie, I am pleased to tell you that the M5 has determined that you have passed the Kobayashi Maru simulation. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And now, the M5, who has analyzed your answers, will award you an honorary Star Trek title on behalf of our podcast. M5, what title shall we award our guest?
Bonnie Moss is awarded the title of Curator of Fine Visual Arts for the Andorian Art Academy.
So, there you go.
Love it. Can I get a t-shirt?
You can get a t-shirt, a hat, and even a big, fat Vulcan salute from me. So, there you go.
Okay. Thank you, John. I'm honored.
All right. Bonnie, please tell people how they can get in touch with you if they want to continue the conversation.
I am on Twitter at NCBonnie1. I am also on Facebook, but I'm not real Facebooky, so Twitter would probably be your best bet.
Bonnie, thank you so much for being part of Trek Profiles.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Here ends this installment of the Trek Profiles podcast, and before we offer a Trek quote to close this episode, I'd like to remind you that you may send us your profound insights, Ferengi business opportunities, or your recipes for a nice Talaxian spice stew to feedback@trekprofiles.com or on Facebook or Twitter at Trek Profiles. Anything you send us may be used in the show or may be fed to a pack of wild targs. This week, I leave you with a quote from Mr. Spock, who in the episode Amok Time said, quote, "After a time, you may find that having is not so pleasing a thing after all as wanting. It is not logical, but it is often true." Close quote. Thanks for listening, and live long and prosper.